Father, we're so thankful for your goodness and your kindness to us this day. We recognize that thou art great and lofty, that there is no one like thee. We are privileged to be your people, to be called by your name, to have great hope in you. Father, I pray that you would help us today to worship you and adore you as we should. I pray, Father, that you'd guard our lips and that you'd help us, Father, to put our attention and our focus where it needs to be, that we might understand great things concerning you. We beseech you, dear Lord, that you would bless our time with Dr. Woodrow and that you would strengthen him and give him the right words to say as he gives us even an update. May our hearts rejoice with the work that you are doing in that faraway land. We pray, Father, that you would continue to bless him and his family and care for them. We thank you for your kindness to them and your grace that has been manifested through their work there over the years. And we beseech you, Father, that that work would continue, that the gates of hell would not prevail against it. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. I just want to say very briefly, recognizing that most of us here know Dr. Woodrow, but some of you, he may be new to you, and he has been a friend and brother for many years, dating back to most of us were in a previous church, Believers Fellowship, and I know for myself, at the very time that I was joining that church in 1979, that Dr. Woodrow was also joining the church, and we were both together at Joe Saul's house. And I remember that very well. And that was really my first encounter with him. And I saw a young man that was full of zeal for the Lord and very hungry for the things of God. And God put a desire in his heart to go to Mozambique. And it's never been anything but unexplainable to me. I could never figure out why anybody would want to go to Mozambique. And you probably couldn't either. But he had a heart for that land. And it carried him there, I believe, in 1989, originally. And the chronicles of Dr. Woodrow would just about fill up one of these rooms. It's just amazing the things that have occurred, the things that God has done through him and through the work that is going on there. And so, it's a privilege to have him. He is a man of God, and we are so thankful for him and his ministry and his family. And would he please come up and give us an update?
Well, I certainly want to take advantage first off to give my greetings to the people here and expression of thanks on the part of our entire family for the interest and the support and the prayers that we know have gone up from this congregation over the years for us, and without which I know we wouldn't have anything worthwhile to share about this morning. And my family's not here with me this morning, but we'll be all together on this Friday night at Trudy Elmer's Clubhouse, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to visit with you some individually at that time. Also, I'll be showing some pictures of Mozambique. That takes about 15 minutes. And then on the 16th of November, we plan to be here in this church for worship as well. So we're looking forward to that. And as it stands right now, our tentative plans are to be back in San Antonio during the month of January, but I haven't cleared that with Grace Missions yet. We want to spend a month with Grace Bible Chapel. And it looks like that'll be in the month of January, but that's not set in stone yet. So we're certainly looking forward to getting back in touch with each of you individually and your families before we leave for Mozambique again, which will probably be sometime next year around April or May. Well, I want to tell some things that the Lord has been doing in Mozambique. A few people here I know I haven't met before, and so I'll include some details to sort of bring you up to date, but for the most part I won't tell too many of the stories that go way back into the past, even though they are wonderful. I love to rehearse them from time to time because they just show the Lord's faithfulness and goodness in response to prayers. But basically, we've been missionaries in Mozambique for 13 years now. I made a trip in 85, again in 89, and our family went over to work beginning 1990. And I went to Mozambique as a general surgeon with a contract to work in what was then a Marxist, socialist, communist country. In one of their government hospitals. Now, the country of Mozambique, we've been there for 3 terms, and over those 3 terms, our work has developed in 3 different directions. The first term, it was almost all medical evangelistic. We worked in a government hospital, 120-bed hospital, but our purpose for being there wasn't primarily to do surgery, but it was to evangelize the people. And I don't think we ever had a single patient come into the operating room without being prayed for in the operating room. We conducted evangelistic rounds regularly. And at the end of the first year, we began having evangelistic services in the main hall of the hospital, where 40 to up to 120, 150 patients and their family members and visitors and hospital staff would participate. And we started that after the first year, and once we got started, I don't think ever a Sunday went by that we didn't hold an evangelistic service there in that government hospital, except when I was out of the country on vacation. And this was remarkable because it was a socialist communist country. And according to their constitution, even a pastor couldn't go in to a government hospital, and all the hospitals were government run, and stand at the bedside of one of his own church members and pray for him out loud. That was illegal. But there we were holding these evangelistic services in the main hall of this government hospital. Because Grace Missions was providing the only doctor at the hospital and providing all the medications for the hospital and a lot of the other supplies, and they were happy to let us do as we wish. So that was the main purpose of the medical work, and the first 4 years was almost exclusively involved in medical evangelism. And then in the second term, we had the opportunity to establish a church in Mozambique, fellows who had been witnessed to at the hospital and been followed up. We had about 9 guys who were discipled for anywhere from 1 to 2 years who had responded to the gospel ministry at the hospital, and they eventually formed a church and asked me to help them run it. And so the second term was involved in getting this church established, and during the third term that church was recognized by the Mozambique government as a legitimate organization that had a valid government and so forth, and we were given the authorization of the government to then invite missionaries to come into Mozambique. That's the main benefit that we have. They recognize that we're not just a fly-by-night operation, and if we want a missionary to come to Mozambique and we're willing to sponsor him in the country, the government will accept his presence there. So that's a great advantage that we now have through that church. So that was what developed in the second term. And then in the third term, the ministry has developed along a third line, and that's an outreach to other churches in the Nampula area, and not just around Nampula, but also throughout the entire country of Mozambique through these FIEL conferences. We have annual conferences for pastors. They've been attended by up to 153 pastors and church workers and their wives, coming from 40 different denominations and church groups throughout Mozambique. And we've held 4 of those conferences. They started at the very first year we went back to the field this last term. And that's an exciting ministry, because the purpose of these conferences is to encourage the men in their own personal spiritual walk with the Lord, to equip them in their ministry, and then to acquaint them with the doctrines of grace. And it's associated with the publishing ministry as well. Banner of Truth type books are published in the Portuguese and distributed free of charge to pastors who are on a special distribution program. They get 1 book a month for free for 36 months. And this is an amazing opportunity for pastors in Mozambique, because they don't even have bookstores in Mozambique. But that's another thing that's developed in connection with this. Just this summer, we had started a bookshop in Nampula, and it's the only Christian bookstore in the northern half of the country. There's one other bookstore in the south, but that's about to close. And so for the last 4 years, the only place people could get books at all, Christian books, in the north of Mozambique was by coming to these annual conferences, and that's one of the reasons they were so well attended, because we would bring in Christian books and sell them at the conference. And then pastors could sign up for this book distribution program and continue to receive free books for 36 months to flesh out a library. They don't even have a library. They're doing well to have a Bible. Some of these pastors have to use Jehovah's Witnesses Bibles, so Bibles are very hard to come by in Mozambique. And that's the ministry that's taken off in the third term. But to give some of you who don't know much about Mozambique a little thumbnail sketch of the country, it's a country on the southeastern coastline of Africa, It's right across that channel of water from the big island of Madagascar, and it's about 1,300 miles in length. Controls a lot of the coastline of southern Africa on the Indian Ocean. And it's a country of 20 million Mozambicans, and it was a Portuguese colony until 1975. And when it was under the control of the Portuguese, it was a relatively prosperous country. But in 1975, after 15 years of unrest and terrorism and so forth by Marxist liberation fighters, African fighters, the country was handed over to an African government. And the sudden imposition of these Marxist, communist economic policies and the mass exodus of all of the Portuguese people, practically, who live in the country, and they represented almost all of the skilled labor force of the country, and a 17-year civil war that started up amongst different rival African factions, rapidly made Mozambique the poorest country in the world, and the country with the highest level of human suffering in the whole world, right up until 1992. And that was the situation we went into when we were sent to Mozambique back in 1990. The civil war was still going on, and the hospital where I worked, about 5 miles outside the city of Nampula, which is the third largest city in the country, it's up in the northern part of the country, that hospital was attacked 4 times during the first 2 years I was there. And some of the nurses were carried away, kidnapped. And one patient died in the course of those attacks, and finally the hospital was closed for a month by the provincial health authorities because of repeated attacks. And that's the only time that the surgical service was closed during the 8 years that Grace Missions was operating it, was when the hospital was closed down. But even though those first years in Mozambique were very difficult, we went without electricity 6 months at a time on 2 different occasions during that first term. We didn't have running water a lot of the time. I had to bring all the water in for the hospital, even in the Land Rover every day when we went to work, and had to have a little generator to power the sterilizing equipment in the operating room. And we used a battery pack, a motorcycle battery, to power the surgical headlamps so that we could see to operate on the patients, because we didn't have overhead lights. Even though there were difficulties on every hand, the Lord, it was a time of seeing God's amazing faithfulness as He got us through all of that. And those of you who received our monthly prayer letters back in those days probably still remember how amazing it was to find out what the Lord was going to do next. For us, it was just always, it seemed like we were careening toward one disaster after another, but before the disaster ever happened, the Lord just cleared it out of the way. But in the second term, things were much more difficult, and we faced continuous opposition against the medical evangelistic work, intense opposition throughout the entire second term. But the Lord turned that on its head, and He used all of that opposition to bring the ministry, the medical ministry, to the attention of the Minister of Health. And it was brought by our adversaries who wanted to close down the medical work. But God totally overturned that in an amazing way, and I still tell this story, but I won't today because it takes too much time. It goes way back to the second term, but just an amazing way in which the Lord made the Minister of Health our personal friend, and out of all of that, and He asked what He could do to help Grace Missions with all the pressure we were getting from our opponents. And I told Him that we'd like to establish our own privately owned and operated mission hospital in the city of Nampula, and He said He would authorize it, and He did. And so that was the end of the second term. Everything was turned on its head. In the past term, the medical evangelistic work has mainly consisted in trying to get this hospital built. During the third term, which is what we just finished, the church planning work that got underway so well during the second term has been under intense opposition, and I'll be detailing some of that. It finally culminated in an attempt early in the term, actually, to get me expelled from the country, and that didn't work. But you've heard probably what happened. The last 3 hours, as I was about to leave the country, I was put under arrest and put in jail in connection with the same opposition, and the Lord has seemingly turned that on its head as well, and I'll share that story in a little bit. But all of that is stemming from opposition to the church planning work that we've had to endure all through this third term, and we're hoping to see that the Lord will somehow use that to propel the church ministry ahead. But that's a thumbnail sketch of these last 3 terms. I want to go into some of the details. First, I want to talk about what's happened in this last term with this Fiel ministry. Fiel is the Portuguese word for faithful, And there's an organization in Brazil that was started by an American missionary there. He's been a missionary to Brazil for 51 years now. It's called Editora Fiel, and that means faithful publishers. Basically what happened to this American missionary, Baptist missionary working in Brazil, Banner of Truth Trust got going, started producing books here in the past 50 years, actually longer than that, I guess, and he got on their mailing list, and he began reading some of these books from Banner of Truth Trust. And he was brought to acquaintance with the doctrines of grace and all of the implications, and it totally transformed his own spiritual life, his own ministry. And he began finding English-speaking Brazilian pastors to share these books with, and it had the same effect on them. And so these men then began translating these books from English into Portuguese and organized a publishing house so that they could distribute these books throughout the entire Portuguese-speaking world. And they began doing that. And now today they have like 130 titles that they have translated. And they started that distribution program where pastors can get on the program and can receive a free book a month for 3 years. And then they began establishing annual conferences. They've had 19 annual conferences now where they bring in internationally renowned speakers. And they invite the pastors who are on the reading program to come for free. Their way is paid. And then anybody else who wants to can pay to come to these conferences. And I just came back from their 19th conference. They had over 1,000 men there. And, of course, the purposes of these conferences are the threefold ones that I've mentioned, to encourage these men in their ministries, to equip them to minister, and to acquaint them with the doctrines of grace and the rich legacy that's been left to us by the Reformation Fathers. And so they get these annual conferences going. And then, in addition, they've been sending out a quarterly, every 3 months, journal that goes throughout the Portuguese-speaking world with excellent articles on along Reformed lines. And it was in 1985 that I was getting ready to go to Mozambique, and I sent off to all the Brazilian publishing houses wanting to find out what books they distributed. When I got the list from Editora Fiel, I was just so excited because it was Banner of Truth in Portuguese. And I was so thankful to know that that resource was available as church planting got underway in Mozambique. And then the next step came in 1993. The church in Mozambique had just gotten started, our congregation, which is along the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith. That's what we follow. And I put in the first order a couple $1,000 worth of books from Editora Fiel so that we could make them available to people as they got involved in the church. And let's see. Oh, well, there were a lot more books than our congregation wanted to buy, so I set up a little bookshop in our front living room. And let pastors from other churches come in and pick out books that they wanted to buy, and they began telling their friends about it. So we had a little bookshelf, a bookshop, an informal bookshop, bookshop in our house, in our living room, which Julie appreciated. For along with all the other things we squeezed in there, the five kids, and she and myself, and then later on I brought in 2 dogs, and now I had all these pastors there coming in and out, running it like a bookshop. But a couple of years after that, Rich Denham, who's the American missionary, heads up Editora Fiel, wrote and said he'd like to extend their publishing ministry into Mozambique, put Mozambican pastors on this distribution program, and he wanted somebody who could head that up. And I put him in touch with a good friend of mine working in Mozambique in Maputo. He's a Brethren missionary sent out by Brethren churches. He was educated at Westminster Seminary. That's in Philadelphia, right? He was educated at Westminster Seminary. And I guess if you take a Brethren missionary and you put them through Westminster Seminary, they come out Reformed Baptist, because that's what he calls himself. And so I put him in touch with Rich Denham, who's also Reformed Baptist. And he's headed up that literature distribution program. And, of course, I told the pastors who were interested in books, buying books from us, about this program and got them registered in it. They began telling their friends, and their friends got registered as well, pastor friends. And so it turned out that the majority of the people on this program were up around Nampula, where I am, even though the missionary who runs it's 1,200 miles away in the south. And so he decided in the year 2000, that was the next step, he wanted to get up to Nampula and get to know these men that he was corresponding with and sending Christian books to. And I suggested to him, well, why don't we just get a little conference for these men? and we'll call it the FIEL conference, just like they do in Brazil. And it'd just be a little informal conference for 10 to 15 men. And the first sign that the Lord was in this and that it wasn't just the idea of men functioning entirely on their own was when we wrote a mutual friend of ours. He's a pastor in Johannesburg. It's the church that we both attend, this friend of mine and myself, whenever we're out of the country on holidays. And he's an internationally known speaker. You probably don't know him, Martin Holt, but he preaches at conferences in Europe and England and Canada and the United States, particularly amongst Reformed Baptist circles. And he had always been interested, always said he wanted to get up to Nampula and see the work that was going on there. And so we thought, well, we'll invite him to come up, and if he comes up, well, that's when we'll have the conference while he's here. And sure enough, he accepted. He said he'd preach 7 messages to these 10 to 15 men. So that was the first, and this is an internationally, you know, renowned preacher, and he's going to preach to these men. And so that was the first step. The second step, he wrote off to Editora Fiel and told them we'd like to have a Fiel conference in Mozambique, and that we were setting it up and wanted their approval. And they said they not only approved, but they wanted to send their founder, Richard Denham, to be present for this first conference. It was sort of a historic event. Well, we said, no, that's not a good idea because this is our first attempt and there's going to be lots of mistakes. It's going to be kind of rough. And there's only 10 or 15 guys going to be coming. It really wouldn't be worth sending him all the way from Brazil. But the Lord overruled. He directed their decision and they decided, no, they wanted to send Richard Denham. And his presence at the conference was a real animating force. And he brought with him $4,000 worth of books. As you can imagine, $4,000 worth of books spread out amongst 10 to 15 pastors. That would be a real bonanza. Guys who had never seen books until they started getting them from Editora Fiel. But there weren't just 10 to 15 pastors. Turns out that the literature that they'd been distributing in this quarterly that came out every 3 months had so impressed these pastors and others that they were telling everybody about it. And when people began signing up to register for this conference, we didn't get 10 or 15 registrations. We had 137 men that said they wanted to come. And that threw me into a real quandary because I didn't see how we'd possibly be able to host 137 men with the facilities that we had. I had gone off to South Africa about a month and a half before this conference in order to buy building supplies for our construction work that's been going on all through this last term, and also to buy the material that we needed to host a conference like this. I mean, Mozambique is so primitive, even to do something like this, you have to go out of the country to buy materials to host a conference like this. And I had bought plates and dishes and kitchen materials. We had to cook all the meals ourselves and prepare them and serve them ourselves, and I had to buy all of that equipment in South Africa. And when I left, Carl Peterson, who was heading up the FIEL program in Mozambique, told me we had 20 pastors registered to come. Well, that's what we expected to have, so that was fine. And then just as I was packing up the Land Rover to bring everything back, I called him to find out, you know, what the status was. He said we had 54 people coming. Well, that was okay because I had material for 86. I had enough material to serve 86 men. Now, this was for, you know, the future years. So I wasn't too worried about it. Well, it took 4 days longer than I expected. It took about 10 days to get home to Mozambique. And when I finally got home to Nampula, just 6 days before the conference, and there was a lot of pressure now because the trip home took 4 days longer than I meant for it to. And that's amazing. To travel 2,000 miles in Mozambique takes 10 days. And it took us 10 days on this occasion to make that trip. 4 days longer than I expected. I only had 6 days to get everything set up, and I called Carl to find out, you know, how many men are coming, and that's when he told me we have 137 on the list, and, well, we only have material to feed 86. But as it turned out, when the men finally showed up, and again, we see the Lord's hand in this, though 137 wanted to come, only 85 were actually able to get to Nampula. And, of course, the Lord had provided 86 place settings and material to handle that many men, and because he knew all along who was coming and how many he expected, how many he was bringing to the conference. And we've been praying that the Lord would bring the men that he wanted to the conference. Some of the men, of course, had to have lodging, and we were responsible for setting that up as well, but this first year we were not that well organized, and we had no idea of all the out-of-town pastors who had friends and family members in the city that they'd stay with, who had fellow pastors in their denomination that they could that they could bunk with during the conference and who actually would need lodging. And so just pulled a figure out of the air. We reserved 20 beds, went around to different downtown boarding houses and reserved 20 beds. And when the men showed up the first day and signed in and we found out how many needed beds, there were 18 that needed beds. So we were just thankful again to see the Lord's hand in that first conference. And then on top of that, when I got back just 6 days before the conference, you know, we have to build our own kitchen each year. We throw up a bamboo kitchen, which you'll see pictures of on Friday night. It takes 2 days to get the kitchen built and bring in all the supplies and set it up. But we only had 6 days to get everything set up, and I wondered where in the world in Mount Pula are we going to find tables and chairs to seat 137 people for meals. And when I showed up at the conference hall, we still hadn't solved that problem. I also was looking for greenery to sort of decorate the meeting hall, and I wondered where in Mozambique do you get that. And I showed up a couple of days before the conference to get things ready at the meeting hall, and the night before they'd had this big wedding reception. Some wealthy guy in Mozambique and Nampula had a big reception after his son or daughter's wedding, and there was a terrible mess we had to clean up, but there were all these chairs and all these tables that he had collected from friends and I don't know where all. And so we just contacted him and said, hey, would you mind leaving these things for 4 more days? We'll rent them from you, and we could use them for our conference. So there they were. And he said, fine. So the tables and the chairs and the greenery, the plants, all this stuff was already right there. So we just cleaned the place up, and we had the conference. But it was so encouraging, and again, to see that this wasn't something that originated in our mind. It was the Lord's purpose and plan to have the conference, and he provided the speaker, provided the translator. Carl Peterson brought a man out to translate from Maputo who hadn't been tested. He just heard this guy was good at translating, and maybe he was good if you went down to the marketplace and you needed somebody to translate for you while you bought vegetables and so forth. But he couldn't translate a message that was coming, you know, rapid fire and squeeze in rapid, spontaneous translation of the messages. And he, the first message just went really flat because he couldn't translate what the pastor was preaching. Well, Tyler Hopkins had sent Batista Boa, a Mozambican student who had just finished 3 years of training at his seminary in South Africa, very fluent, of course, in English and Portuguese. He sent him to the conference, and he was just sitting there in the audience. And when our translator was failing so miserably, we ran out to Batista and said, Batista, you try. Next message, we want you to translate it. Well, he did a great job. He was very fluent in both Portuguese and English. And so we just thanked the Lord that he provided the translator. And everything else. And that's the way the conferences have been. The Lord's hand has been very evident throughout in each of the conferences. The one we had last year, we had 153 pastors present and church workers and their wives. And we sold 839 books and 500 booklets and 75 Geneva study Bibles. And then this last year we raised the registration fee. These conferences end up costing us about $100 per person who attends for the meals, the lodging, and the books that they buy, because the books are sold at only a half of their actual cost of publication. And we charge $6 to the men to come. That's a lot of money for them. And but we want to be sure that the men who come consider that the conference is worth the struggle to get there and worth $6 registration fee. And this last conference we had 113 men, so it actually had come down in numbers, but it was really an excellent group of men. These are men who've been on the reading program now, men who think that this literature is really important in their ministry, and men who are intelligent and educated and able to read, and men who've come to these previous conferences, and men who are willing to pay $6, which doesn't seem like anything to us. That's not even pocket change anymore here. But that's a lot of money for them to come to the conference. And we're just really impressed with the quality, with the caliber of men that are being selected out, who are coming to the conferences, who are receiving the literature, who are buying literature with their own money. And so we're very encouraged by this last conference. And we're just thankful for this opportunity to minister to the church in Mozambique. Now, I can go back to the years when I was working at the hospital every day and having these weekly evangelistic services, And we had up to 150 was the maximum that we ever had at these evangelistic services, but the people were always very attentive. The services, we had about a 30 to 40 minute presentation of the gospel, and people would really listen attentively, and then afterwards we'd give them scripture portions that they could take back and read. And I'd make rounds afterwards, and I'd see people, the patients in their beds, reading these gospel tracts, trying to understand what the scriptures were saying. And I was really encouraged to see that we had awakened an interest, a desire to know Jesus Christ through the Bible. But I always was concerned, what are they going to do when they leave the hospital? They're going to either go to a Catholic church because they think this hospital is a Catholic hospital because it had been built by the Catholics before the Marxists took it over. Or they're going to just go to whatever church is convenient. And the evangelical churches in Mozambique are... works salvation almost across the board. And we were concerned about what kind of follow-up they'd be getting when they finally hooked up with the church. Well, so we're so thankful that we've got these PL conferences going on right there in Nampula, the whole country of Mozambique. The conferences are taking place there, and of 113 pastors at the last one, 82 of them came from our state. And so we're concentrating on the Nampula pastors. And I'm just thankful that we have an opportunity to help the church in the province of Nampula develop, acquaint them with the doctrine of salvation by grace through faith. Even as we're having the opportunity to build this mission hospital, which is a big evangelistic meal for us, an opportunity to tell people about Jesus Christ, but now when they leave the hospital, there's a much greater likelihood that they can be followed up by churches that are going to preach the gospel of salvation by grace through faith. And so I don't see any coincidence between the mission hospital being established in Nampula and God raising up these PL conferences and this literature distribution program that focuses in the province of Nampula. I think the Lord's hand is in all of this. It's not us doing it. And even as we pray, we don't even know when we take steps what the Lord's big plan is. But I'm thankful that we can look back thus far and see that the Lord has a big plan. And this is part of it. And in our ignorance, He's working it out. So that encourages us, and we need encouragement because there's been a lot of difficulties, a lot of opposition. I'll just narrate some of the opposition, some of the difficulties we face in the church planting realm, which has gone on. It's been a major emphasis for us over the past term. The one I won't be able to touch on is the hospital construction, but I will tell you it's exciting. One quick vignette about that. Up until now, we have spent $265,000 on construction. And I just thank the Lord. We have not, as you are aware, we've not asked anybody for money. We've not said we need money. We've not said we need this much money. We don't talk about it. We just let people know what the Lord is doing, and people send in money. And so $265,000 has been spent thus far on all of the development project. $80,000 of that has gone into the residence, Grace Missions Residence, Guest House, and Office Complex. But when I, this was amazing to me, when I got back home to San Antonio and was able to get hold of the records, the financial records of Grace Missions, I didn't know because we just have, you know, with all volunteer labor, communication is not that great, and I didn't know how much money had been coming in to Grace Missions since December of last year. I didn't know how much money Grace Missions had in the bank. And they didn't know from me how much money we were spending. We spent a lot of money the last few months putting in the foundations for the hospital and finishing the two sanitation blocks in the evangelistic pavilion. And they didn't know how much I'd spent because I hadn't had time to present my report. Well, I presented my report to them the same time I got the report that they gave to me so we could settle up on the accounts. And at the end of the day, Grace Missions had $3,000 left. And, you know, that's working in ignorance. I didn't know how much they had. They didn't know how much I was spending. And there was a project. We wanted to pour the slab on the foundation, which we didn't have time to do. But unbeknownst to me, we didn't have the money to do it either. But the Lord knew all that. And I'm just thankful that we stayed solvent. But to me, it's significant. $265,000 spent and $268,000 provided. And again, we just see the Lord's hand in all of these things. We operate in darkness and in ignorance, but thankfully we serve a God who can lead us even as we're operating in darkness and ignorance and keep us out of trouble and help us hopefully to do what He wants us to do, even though we don't know it. And you know, it's a caricaturization that people give of the doctrines of grace, acting as if man's a little puppet out there and God's up there operating the strings. And of course we know that it's not that. But I'm so thankful that there is an element of that, that you can be totally ignorant and you don't know what you're doing, but the Lord is directing your steps, even as you go. Because that's what we want, I hope. That's certainly what I want. And I thank the Lord for the way He has set it up and the way He operates it. And the doctrines of grace certainly properly illustrate the correct relationship between God and man and what God is doing to glorify Himself and graciously using men to do it. And we have the privilege of cooperating with that as well by His grace. But I want to talk about the church work in the next 10 minutes. That's all I'm going to say about the medical evangelistic work for the past term. With regard to the church work, you know that we had about nine, I think I briefly summarized this at the beginning. Nine men responded. I did say this. Nine men responded to the evangelistic activities at the hospital, whom we also developed a long-term relationship with. A lot of people responded, but these were nine men that we were able to disciple during the first term for anywhere from a year to 2 years in various cases. And they decided they wanted to establish a church finally. They were all involved in their own churches. I got them involved in churches because that was part of what a believer is supposed to do. But they began to realize that the churches that they were participating in had practices and teachings that contradicted what they were learning from the Bible and the Bible classes, and they wanted in time to start a church of their own, and so I helped them to do that. And that got going. The church got established during the second term. And when it was finally registered, again, we look back retrospectively and see how the Lord was working. When it was actually registered, the guy who registered it, first of all, we sent in our papers to be registered because we had to do that to be legal in Mozambique. This is interesting. I'm not going to tell too many stories here. I'm not going to get to the end, I'm afraid. But in Mozambique, the way they had it set up under the Marxist regime, you could not have public meetings without having authorization from the government. And a church, in particular, couldn't meet unless it had authorization from the government. Otherwise, it was an illegal meeting. All meetings were illegal. Public meetings were illegal, unless the government called it. And but to be registered with the government, you had to have a congregation of 500 members. And, of course, that's a catch-22. How can you get registered as a church with 500 members if you're never allowed to meet? And it's just, you know, that's the idea. You just don't get anywhere. You don't get off the ground. But again, because of the Lord uses the medical work all the time as a trump card to trump anything the evil one puts down, and because Grace Missions was so favorably received by the government in Nampula, we were able to go, and these guys wanted to get started as a church, and we got permission to go ahead and meet, even though we couldn't possibly fulfill the government requirements. Just with the understanding that when we got up to 500 people, we'd get registered and make it all legal. And so eventually, we couldn't get 500 members, of course, but everybody who participated in an activity at the church, we would ask them, would you please sign our petition to be registered as a church? So we had all the visitors, everybody sign this petition. And we finally, after 5 years, got up to 500 names on the list, and we sent it in to be registered, and the government said, no, we want you to start over because we want to have the birth date and the address of all these people as well. I said, oh, man, it's going to take us 5 years to come up another 500 names at that rate. And they said, well, just go do it. So we started doing that. And 2 months later, we were quite satisfied with that situation because we didn't see ourselves as a church, as I'll hopefully have time to explain. We didn't have biblical leadership. We think if somebody's going to be a church, they have to have biblical elders. They've got to have at least 2 elders, biblical leadership, and they need to have a strong core of Christians. I mean, we had a big group of people meeting every Sunday, but we only had of that group 8 people who were definitely believers, and we hoped maybe 4 more that the Lord was working in. And so we didn't feel like we could call ourselves a church anyway. So we didn't mind that we weren't registered. But then a fellow called up 2 months later and says, I'm sending a guy up to Nampula. This is the minister of justice. Sending a fellow up to Nampula. We're going to register your church on Friday. We want you to get everybody together, and we're going to do it and send up all your paperwork again. And he asked me over the phone, who are your leaders? So I gave him the name of the top 3 leaders in the church, the African leaders, and then I listed myself 4th. I said, I'm the secretary of the church. But when he filled out the documents, he put my name at the top. And he called me the Secretary General, which makes me the superintendent of the denomination. And then after that, he put our three African leaders. Now, he did that wisely because he realized that the Africans were relatively uneducated and so forth. He had more confidence in the missionary than he did in those men. Well, I thank the Lord that he did that, because when problems came up later in the church, that was very instrumental, the fact that I was the one that was responsible to the government for the church. We got the church organized, and when some of the difficulties that we faced all along the way, first of all, we established a policy in the church that alienated some people, that it needed to be a self-supporting church, because the idea is the congregation needs to be self-propagating, needs to be self-supporting, and it needs to be self-governing, and to be an independent church. And so we told them that Grace Missions will never be able to provide more than 50% of the material or financial support for any undertaking of the church. You guys have to come up with at least half of it. If you can build mud huts to live in, then we can worship in a mud hut, which you guys can build. And we'll just function at what you can do. We're not going to have the mission come in and send in automobiles and cars and build buildings and so forth. Well, that was an unpopular policy, because they were hoping that they would get some of the men, who, even amongst the leaders and particularly people who joined later, were hoping to get financial help. And then we also wanted to be sure that the motive for being involved in the church was spiritual, that people were coming because they had a hunger for the Word of God, not because they saw the church as an opportunity to make wealthy friends and maybe later get employment and so forth. So we always limited the financial help that was given to the church. Then we required regenerate church membership, and I saw this was a problem very early on. We started with 9 men, and within a few months after we opened the doors, we met 3 months without anybody coming but those 9 men and their families. And when it seemed to be functioning okay, we opened the doors and said, whoever wants can come join us for worship. And in a short time, we had 65 people there worshiping with us, counting the children, and that they didn't know the Lord. And I thought, well, man, we've only got 9 people who are baby believers, and some of them I don't think are even saved yet, and they're trying to direct a group of 65 people who are very nominal. And by the time we could establish church membership, we had 65 adults who were now participating regularly in the church. Some of them had a pretty active role. And when we had church membership, we required everybody to meet with the leaders of the church and answer 3 questions. Why do you want to be a member of the church? Now, that's important in Mozambique. It's important anywhere. We wanted a good answer to that. But in Mozambique, it's important because the African mindset, they're not individualists like Americans. They don't idolize that, and they don't revere it. We have this rugged individualism that we sort of make. We respect in this country, but not in Mozambique. In African culture, you need to be part of the herd, and it's actually a sin to not be part of the herd, to go off and follow your own way, go your own way. And of course, that's a problem in the scriptures, because the scriptures say, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And many of those enter by it, but the way is narrow and the gate is small that leads to life, and few are those who find it. And that mitigates in African culture against a proper biblical church, because their idea is you've got to be part of the whole mass of humanity there. And if you go your own way, that's sin. And when we ask people why they want to be part of the church, the question, the answer they cannot give, which is would be the one deepest in their hearts, is, well, because you cannot be alone. You've got to be part of the group. And that is deep in the African heart. You've got to identify with a group, find a group and join with them, whatever it is. You just can't be a loner in life. So we're not wanting that answer. Another answer that they can't give, which they don't usually, but this is very deep in their heart, is because I got to have a big crowd at my funeral. And that really is important, almost the whole thrust of living. The only thing important about this human life is how many people you can get to attend at your funeral. Because the important thing is the hereafter. And the most important step about the hereafter is how you start it. And you got to have a big crowd at your funeral. And that's the important thing. We had a lady come to our church. A lot of people would come to our church once every 2 months just to identify themselves with this group. I'm part of this group, but they don't practice it. But they do come every 2 months so that they don't lose their affiliation with the group. And we had a lady who started showing up, an elderly lady. showing up every about once a month, once every 6 weeks. And she was very weak and infirm, and sure enough, 6 months or so after she started coming, she died. And the people showed up in block, you know, like you're supposed to do. The whole church showed up at her funeral to put in a good attendance, and there were some guys there who were ready to run the funeral. But they got there and they found out that there was a Muslim congregation present, and a Catholic congregation present, and another evangelical congregation present. A woman had been going from church to church, four different churches. She knew she was weakening, and so she was going to four different, she got to a mosque and a Catholic church and two Protestant congregations to be sure that she had the people there. And of course, nobody did the funeral because they didn't know who she really affiliated with. But that's African mindset. And so they can't say, well, I've got to have a big crowd at my funeral. That's why I'm joining this church. And another thing is that they won't say this, but in African culture too, it's one of the reasons, one of the benefits of being part of the group is that when disaster strikes, they don't have health insurance, life insurance, and fire insurance. And basically, they pass the hat, the group that you're with, it's understood in African culture. Everybody chips in, and then when it happens to you, you pass the hat, and everybody chips in. And that's how you recover from your hut being washed away during a rainstorm, or the bread earner dying, or having to get a cast for some broken bone for one of your kids. That's how they finance it. And they can't say that. They can't say, because I don't have life insurance, health insurance, social security, fire insurance, and so forth. Well, out of 65 adults who were participating after we had instituted church membership, only 12 were members. And some of those, I mean, because we believe you need to have a regenerate membership. And, oh, wait, I didn't. The other two questions was, how did the Lord save you? And we want to see evidence that they've come from darkness into light. And then the third one is, what are you doing besides going to church to further your own spiritual growth? And there we just want to see that they're doing something besides just coming to church, that they're having worship at home or reading the Bible or praying, that they've got a developing a personal relationship with the Lord. And so that has created a problem among some people in the church. Even regenerate church members sometimes can't understand why a friend who comes to church regularly and wants to be a member isn't accepted by the leadership as a member, because they're not able, they don't sit in on an interview for one thing, and they don't hear the answers they give to these questions, and they're not able to discern between who's regenerate and who's not. And then we have the issue of biblical church leadership in our church, which has been a difficult one. I'm running over. We believe that you have to be qualified by the Scriptures to be an elder. And so we have provisional leaders. And we tell our men, you know, we're not elders. We can't call ourselves that. Until the Lord raises up two elders, we're just provisional leaders. And when we have two elders, the church leadership passes over to them. And that rankles some of the men even who were leaders in the church, one anyway. And then we actually have to practice church discipline when people stray. And we, before we established church membership, we had a lot of people who called themselves participants in the church. They took communion, and that they were doing scandalous things. And when they couldn't correct their ways and mend their ways, ultimately after counseling, we ended up expelling 8 people over a period of years. And that has alienated some one particular individual anyway, who's accompanied all of this and hasn't agreed with it. And then finally, those are the areas: limited financial help, regenerate church membership, exercising church discipline, and requiring biblical church leadership, not allowing our provisional leaders to call themselves elders or pastors. And in one case, we had to remove actually some church leaders because moral failures that rendered them unqualified even to be provisional leaders. And so anyway, one of the fellows, a seed of bitterness got rooted in his heart, and he decided he was going to have to free the church from the from the scourge of a missionary and our main leader, who's Arnaldo Rodolfo. And I've run out of time. I've got to stop. But I will say he attempted to have me expelled from the country by telling the governor, writing letters to the governor saying that I had stolen $10,000 from the church, and that I had diverted relief aid sent to the church, containers of clothing, containers of bicycles, containers of books and literature, and other relief aid vehicles that have been sent, besides the $10,000 in cash, also $8,500 that had been sent to build the church building, which had been diverted also from its planned purpose. And he said all of this without any documentation whatsoever from Grace Missions or anybody to verify that it was true. He met for 2 months with the Department of Religious Affairs, telling them all before. He said that that neither Arnaldo nor I, our African leader, ever attended the church. That we were, it was just a front that we were setting up so we could get money in the name of the church from the States and spend it divided amongst ourselves. Besides saying that about Arnaldo, he also said that that Arnaldo had a second wife in the Bible in the neighborhood, and that he was he told church members secretly, which we didn't know about, that he was planning on divorcing his wife, and that he was given to drunken debauchery, and he was teaching his son how to be sexually immoral, and all these stories. And even in the government levels, they listened to this without any evidence whatever to back it up. And then they went, he took it to the next level above the Department of Religious Affairs. They passed it on up to the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice listened to it and then told him to write a letter, send it to the governor of the province who has authority to expel missionaries on 24 hours notice, which he has done in the past. And so he wrote the letter, which I finally saw about 2 years later, a very scandalous letter full of all these charges, false charges. But the governor finally acted responsibly and he said to the Department of Religious Affairs, you need to find out if this is true. And that's the first I'd heard about this, and that led to an expose where we found out he was doing all this against Arnaldo as well. His plan was to have me expelled from the country, and then after he'd already told the people in the church all these same stories, he was going to have Arnaldo expelled from the church, and then he would be the number one person in charge of the church. And he was to get the people to go along, those who were skeptical about the stories he was spreading, he said, look, we'll get rid of the missionary, and we will own all these automobiles and a truck, and we will own a building which belonged to Grace Missions, and other things. And so he got support from some people by that means. But it all failed because the truth came out, and over a period of a year, we dealt with this man privately first, and then finally publicly, and had him expelled from the church. However, the congregation had divided during this time, and a lot of people followed him, either thinking he might be right, might be telling the truth, or thinking that there was going to be material benefit at the end of it. And so after a year, we told them, we've removed him from the church. He can't function as your leader. He can't even come to church services, at Believers Fellowship. We now have two congregations going. And if this creates a hardship for you, we're happy to come and take over again the teaching responsibilities, myself and Arnaldo. They accepted that at first, but then the congregation said, after Mauricio had his say, no, we think Mauricio's telling the truth. We think you're framing him, so we're going to go with Mauricio. And so we told them, well, if you go with Mauricio and accept him as your leader, you're going to have to leave Believers Fellowship behind. You can't call yourself Believers Fellowship, and we'll have to disfellowship the whole congregation. And they said, fine, we'll accept that. And so that took 6 months. We had to bring in, all this was done legally because Mauricio was on our church charter, and we legally had to remove him. And then we did remove the church over a period of 6 months with public meetings with other pastors from other congregations present. And finally, that church was disfellowshipped, but they continued to use the name Believers Fellowship and continued to meet at the church property, which we told them they could continue to meet there, but they couldn't use the church name as Believers Fellowship. But they continued to do that, insisting that they were Believers Fellowship. By this time, all the documents of the church had been changed, and it was totally in the hands of myself, Arnaldo, our other missionary, and another African leader. And so we finally told them, well, we'll have to sell the property then. If you're going to continue to call yourself Believers Fellowship, we'll have to sell the property, the church property that you're meeting on. And give all the proceeds to the government to be used for distribution for relief aid for orphans and widows in Nampula. So that's what we've worked out. And that's what our adversary objected to, was losing the church property. And so the sale was supposed to take place in July. This is all done in conjunction with the Department of Religious Affairs and with full information given to the other congregation. And to make things worse, Mauricio had appropriated the building that belongs to Grace Missions and was using it as his private school and charging the students for running his school out of the classroom that Grace Missions had built on the church property, which had never been used by the church. It was strictly for Bible classes. And so now he was going to be without a place to hold his school. So the 3 hours before I left the country, he went down to the police and he said the same stories he'd already told before and that had already been disproven at the Department of Religious Affairs. But he told it to the police officer in charge and said, "You've got to arrest this man because he's leaving the country with $10,000 that belongs to the church. And if you don't get him now, in 3 hours he'll be gone." And so they showed up and arrested me. And they filled out the warrant in the name of Pastor Missionary Charles Leroy Woodrow. I'm only known in Mozambique as Dr. Carlos. And so they didn't know who they were filling the warrant out against, who was being accused. But when they brought me into jail, it was 6 o'clock that evening. They tried to call the man who filled out the warrant for my arrest to tell him you're making a big mistake here. Something's got to be wrong here. But he had left work and hadn't gotten home. He didn't get home until 2 a.m. And he called back at 2 a.m. But it was too late. They had to put me in jail. But they didn't put me in the cell block. They put me in the police officers' break room. And then later in the evening, they moved me around to the public waiting area. So I just slept on a bench in the public waiting area until the commandant came in the morning, and he did a quick investigation, turned me loose, and he sent the police out to pick up Mauricio, put Mauricio in jail for conning the police. That was the official charge that they brought against him, conning him into arresting somebody on false charges. They wanted me to take him to court, and I told them, no, it's a personal offense, and I'm not allowed to fight back that way. And so I wouldn't press charges, but they kept him in jail anyway, just out of spite on their part, for 2 weeks. And apparently during those 2 weeks, from what I hear, the congregation up and left the church property, and the school disbanded, and apparently everything is vacant now, and the sale will go through. We couldn't sell it in July as we had planned because the Portuguese man who was buying it was out of the country, and he just got back at the end of September. So that's what that was all about. The opposition stemmed initially from unfavorable policies, but of regenerate church membership, biblical church leadership, limited financial aid to the church because we don't want to confuse the motives in the church work, and then practice of church discipline. But the devil is strong in Mozambique. One last word. I went back to 14 sequential missionary families who have worked in the northern part of Mozambique beginning in 1960. From 1960 to 1995, of the 14 families who came during that interval, all but 3 had to leave, curtail their ministries. 11 had to curtail their ministries. 6 of them were expelled from the country by the government or by factions within the churches they ministered to. 2 of them left because they saw that that was happening, and they left before it could happen. 1 left because the husband died in a motor vehicle accident, so the family went home. Another one left because of health problems with their family. And 1 left just because of general difficulty living in Mozambique. And of the 3 that leaves, who've come during that time, have been forced out after 1 or 2 terms, of the 3, 2 of us have weathered. This was one of them you just heard, and other missionaries had a similar example, who's survived. So the devil is strong. He's still there, but he's had to contend with an attempt to have him expelled from the country as well. So the devil is strong in Mozambique, and I think that he's behind this. And we just give thanks to God that we're still standing, that we're still alive. In fact, we've been in Mozambique longer than any other missionary family in the north. We've been there 13 years now. And we marvel that we're still there. And we don't take anything for granted, and I don't want you all to take anything for granted. Please continue to pray for us, because in any war, people die on both sides. The Lord's going to win, but there won't be many casualties along the way, and we could be the casualty next. And so we just appreciate your prayers for us thus far, and pray you continue to do that. I'll share more. I had prayer requests and so forth. I've gone over. I'll share more Friday night, and just in terms of a few details. But thank you for this opportunity, and please pray for the church. We need a trained pastor, teacher, missionary. to come out and take over leadership of the church. That's a full-time job. And then we need the church hospital construction to continue and to be finished, and then we'll need missionary doctors and medical people to come out. If we get it built in 2 years, we need people there in 2 years. They need to be in the pipeline now to come and practice. So those are our main prayer requests. And just for survival in Mozambique. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for running over.